This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The end of the Sefer is a strange development. Vayeshev Yisrael Bashitim, and Yisrael was dwelling in Shittim, Vayochel Ha'om Liznos El Benos Moav. And the people started having relationships with the daughters of Moab, Moabite women. Vatikreno La'om Lezivche Eloheihen, and they invited the Jewish people to their religious banquets. Vayochal Ha'om, and the people ate. Vayishtachavu Le'Eloheihen, and they bowed down to their gods. Obviously they ate kosher. And the bowing down to their gods was more of a formality and an act of politeness than anything else. And all that would be bad enough, but God doesn't lose his temper yet. It's after the next sentence that God loses his temper. Vayitzomed Yisrael leval pe'er. Unculus translates Vayitzomed as the ischabar. Yisrael became joined together, became united with Baal Peor. Vayichar af Hashem b'Yisrael, and then God gets angry, and there's a plague, etc. It's difficult enough to understand how people on this stature and on this level could have become attached to any form of idolatry. But Baal Peor, you can't imagine what a system of idolatry that was. It was bad enough, we once discussed the Markulis. Remember, we once talked about the Markulis, the heap of stones. That was bad enough. But that's nothing. I mean, the Markulis has got nothing on Baal Peor. If you want to hear about a real way out of Avodah Zorah, it's Baal Peor. It's so way out that, frankly, it wouldn't be fitting to you as an audience or to the Sforim in front of which I stand to tell you how they used to serve Baal Peor. But it was very disgusting. And the more disgusting you could make it, the better it was. The Gemara reported that somebody came and did the most... You can't imagine how disgusting. You just imagine the worst you can think of, and it's worse than that. And this man was congratulated for his innovative methods of avoda, his innovative system of service and dedication to Baal Peor. Just to give you an idea of the line upon which I'm thinking, we treat our toilets with a great deal more dignity and respect than they treated Baal Peor. And that was the avodah, that's how you served him. That's just unbelievable. That's of all the systems of idolatry, that's what the Jewish people should have become attached to. What is the system of Baal Peor all about? You know, we live in a very insular sort of life. We live in an insular way geographically. You know, if we see ourselves as part of the Sydenham area, that's really quite universal. If we see ourselves as part of Johannesburg Jewry, and that's just, it's unheard of that anybody should be as universal as that. And certainly if we see ourselves as part of a continent or a world, I mean, that's just ridiculous. But we're also historically insular. And we always think that what's happened before, again, we always think we're living in a very special and unique time, and we don't understand and feel enough the flow, the tides of history that have developed and that have taken place over the centuries and centuries of history, Jewish and general. One of the things that worries us particularly is the age of permissiveness, the 1960s, the 70s, and their tremendously destructive effect on society. We're only now beginning to feel the damage caused by that permissive society. We're beginning to feel it now. Our economic situation is as a result of that. Our moral situation is as a result of that. Our educational situation is as a result of that. Our population distribution problems are as a result of that. A lot of the tzoras of today, if one sits down and works out carefully where it comes from the 1960s and from the big intellectuals and the doctors and the psychologists and the philosophers who actually preached the philosophies of the 1960s. It wasn't just the kids. they had intelligent people who were actually promoting it and teaching it as a system. They've made one terrible mess. But it's not the first time that there's been such a mess, and it's not the first time that there was such an age as that permissive period. There's a certain thrill in becoming permissive. There's no thrill whatever in being permissive, like all things of the Yetzer Hara. There's a thrill in being hungry and about to eat. But once you're no longer hungry, there's no physical thrill, there's no material thrill just in the eating. Thrill is only in the act of fulfilling your appetite, but once your appetite is fulfilled, there's nothing left. Likewise with permissiveness. The act of becoming permissive is a very exciting experience, but once you're there, there's nothing. The act of breaking down the fence is something which is very, very exciting, and very, very important to many people. The act of destroying, of opening up new areas, of new experiences, things which were previously sanctified and not done, breaking down into those new areas are all experiences which, to an ordinary person, are worth an awful lot. But somehow there have always been things that, as far as the masses are concerned, have been held left alone. In whatever permissive period, there are certain things that, okay, it's not for me. They might have thought that Catholicism wasn't for them, and Judaism wasn't for them, talking about the permissive age of the 60s, but they didn't go around destroying churches and shuls. You want to, part of the permissiveness was everybody must do what they want. You want to go to shul, go to shul, but leave me out of it. But there was a permissive age where they went one step further, where they took the most holy of holies and they degraded that too. That was the age of the ultimate permissiveness, and that was Baal Peor. To take a god and the avodah, the service of that god, was to rub his nose in the dirt. That was the avodah, to make a religion out of the destruction of religion. That was what Baal Peor was. It was the thrill of breaking down the ultimate barrier. Every other barrier had already been broken down. There was only one barrier left unbroken. That was religion. Baal Peor was the final destruction of religion as well. There is no idolatry, no system of idolatry that is as diametrically opposed to Torah as Baal Peor is. Obviously all systems of idolatry are. But Baal Peor is not even idolatry in a sense. It's a denial of idolatry, but it's a denial of everything. It's a denial of all forms of discipline, whatever. And all forms of things which are special and things which are holy. And that was the essence of Baal Peor, to take the ultimate barrier and destroy that too. I want to talk to you very briefly about how thrilling that really is, and why it's so thrilling. It's thrilling because we're made up not only of our physical beings, but we have a spiritual side to us too. And our neshamas aren't used to barriers. Our neshamas aren't used to restrictions. Our neshamas aren't used to being locked up. And we rebel when we're locked up. It's a rebellion against authority, and rebellion against restraint, and rebellion against discipline is actually a spiritual response. An animal doesn't do it. An animal quite happily puts himself under the yoke and gets into his habits and lives accordingly. That's not a problem. The more spiritual the human being, the more he has the tendency to rebel against restriction and against restrictiveness. I'll give you two examples. The one example is the Gemara in Sanhedrin, where Rav Nachman says, this is on Dafkab Vavamud Beis, talking about a person, Amar Rav Nachman, Hechoshud al Heoroyus Kosher Leidus. The Gemara is discussing who is permitted to give evidence, who can we accept as a witness, and whom can't we. And Rav Nachman says that even a person who is not careful about his sexual relationships, in other words, he's a permissive person, nevertheless, if he's frum in other areas, he's Kosher Leidus, we can use him as a witness. But Rav Nachman agrees, Inyan Edus Isha Shu Posel, not on matters of Arayas. He can't give evidence on matters of man-women relationships. Omar Ravina v'itayim Rav Topa, says Ravina, and some say it was Rav Topa, Loi Omaran, that only applies Elo La'afuko. When won't we accept him as a witness? only if he's coming to give evidence that a woman is unmarried, that she's divorced, or that her husband died, then we'll be suspicious. What's his motivation? But we don't mind if he comes to give us evidence that a woman is married, that we don't mind, we'll accept him for such a witness. Ask the Gemara the obvious question. Pshita, obviously we will. What possible motivation could there be a man who is loose with his morals for telling us that a woman is already married? What the Gemara answers? Mahu detema, what might you have thought? Ha odifale, he has more fun if she's married. Dichtiv, as it says, Mayim genuvin yimtaku. Kamash malander, it's not like that. I might think, no, that a man who's permissive likes to establish a woman's status as being married, and then he has the fun of breaking down another barrier. So it's quite possible that he is motivated because of his sexual excessiveness to give evidence falsely that she's married. That's how far the fun of breaking down barriers goes. When King David, an old man and about to die, in the second chapter of Melachim Aleph, he calls his son Shlomo, who's going to succeed him, and he gives him various instructions how to treat different people. One of the instructions is, "Vihine imcho shimi ben geiro ven hayemini mi bachuri." You're going to be dealing with Shimi ben Geiro, the man from Binyamin, from the city of Bachuri. "Vuhu kilalani kalolonim retzes biyon lechti machanoim," and he gave me a terrible curse on the day that I was fleeing to Machanaim, when I was having this trouble with Avshalom and I was running away from my own son. And you can imagine in what kind of state I was, as David HaMelech. Shimi ben Geira came out and he cursed me. "V'hu yorad likrosi hayardein," and on my return to take over the throne again, when he realized that he was now in trouble, he cursed me so that he would be on the winning side, because at that time Avshalom was winning. Now that he saw that I was winning, he got me in a weak moment. And I swore to him, saying, "Imamischo bechorev, I won't kill you." So I have not been able to kill Shimi ben Geira, but you, Shlomo, have to look after him. Now, al tenakeu, don't let him off. Ki ishcho chamato, you're very wise. V'yodato et asher ta'aseh lo, you know what you should do to him. And you should bring down his old age with blood into the grave. David didn't have terribly much sympathy for Shimi ben Geira. That's it. Vayishkav David im avosov, and David passed away. Vayikover be'ir David, and he was buried in the Ir David. Whether he's really buried where they say he is on Hatzion or not, we don't know, but it's in that area, it's somewhere there. Now Shlomo takes over. One of the first things Shlomo does is he settles debts with our friend Shimi ben Geira. How does he do that? Vayishlach hamelech vayikro l'shimi. The king sends and calls for Shimi. Now the day has come. Vayomer loin, he says, "Right, Shimi, here's your sentence. B'nei lecho vayis b'Yerushalayim. Get the contractors in and build yourself a nice, beautiful home in Yerushalayim. V'yoshav toshom, and you should occupy the home. V'loi seitze mishom oner v'ona, and you're not allowed to leave Yerushalayim at all. V'hoyo b'yom tzeschol, and it will be on the day that you get out of Yerushalayim. V'avarto es nachal kidron, and you just have to cross nachal kidron. Yadoya teda ki mois tomus, you must know you'll die. Domcho yiye v'roshcho, your blood is on your own head." Some kind of sentence. I wouldn't mind being given a house in Yerushalayim and told never to leave. That's a terrible thing. So he's told, sit and live in Yerushalayim. There's plenty to do in Yerushalayim, particularly at that time. Yerushalayim was the center of the world. Imagine New York and Yerushalayim being combined into one city and being told that's the only place you can live. Or have a place with the beauty of Yerushalayim and the dynamism of New York and the Kedusha of Yerushalayim. Who wants to get out if you've got a house in that place? And there are many people who on principle wouldn't go out. There are many people who held that Alpidim, you're not allowed to go out of Yerushalayim once you're living there. There are many Gedolim, even in the modern day, who've never been out of Yerushalayim. What's a terrible thing? And didn't his father say, kill him? Didn't his father say, bring his old age down with blood to the grave? I mean, Shimi is now not going to be so idiotic as to cross the Nahal Kidron, because he knows that this is for real, this is an oath. If he moves out, he's dead. So he won't move out. It's no problem. Shimi wasn't poor. What you say is good. I shall do as you have instructed. And Shimi is brought in Yerushalayim many, many days. It was fine. It was beautiful. What does Shlomo achieve? Aha. This is what he achieves. It was after 3 years. Two servants ran away from Shimi. They ran to Achish ben Macha, the king of Gat. And Shimi was told, your slaves have run to Gat. And the idiot gets up. Like Bilam, he gets his ass ready. And he went to Gat. And he went to Gat to find his slaves. And he brought them home. And it was told to Shlomo. And he called Shimi in. And he got rid of him. 1, 2, 3. So number one, why is Shimi such an idiot? So your two slaves have run. So either send the police after them, or forget the two slaves. What's more important, the two slaves or your life? But more important, how did Shlomo know so certainly that Shimi was going to do it? Shlomo didn't want to just administer the death sentence without giving Shimi a chance to do it himself. But Shlomo must have been absolutely certain that Shimi was going to run out of Jerusalem. What made him so sure? I wouldn't have thought so. Made such a condition on a man. What did you think, that he's going to run out of Jerusalem and take his life into his own hands? Shlomo must have known it, because he promised his father he would kill Shimi. And now he's giving a condition, so he must have known this would kill Shimi. It's all very well if you decide to go and live in Jerusalem for the rest of your life and not to go out. But when you're banned from going out, that you can't tolerate. It's a completely different thing. One can go a day without eating, it's not terribly hard. But if it's a fast day, you get terribly hungry. What's the difference? You don't like being told what to do. That's normal human nature. We fight against authority. We don't like being instructed. We don't like being guided without the option of disobeying. We don't like being put into a situation where we have to do anything. And even something which we would choose to do becomes an intolerably unpleasant when we are forced to do it. That's human nature. And Shlomo tells Shimi, as wonderful a place as Yerushalayim is, as much as there are thousands of people all over the world who would want nothing better but than to live in Yerushalayim for the rest of their days, just take a man and tell him you're under house arrest. You may not leave Yerushalayim. And all the fun of it goes. And then it becomes a matter of urgency to sneak out. Eventually it will be done. He's going to break that barrier. He's going to try and break out even for a moment, just to breathe a breath of fresh air outside Yerushalayim. Just not to feel restricted by these artificial restrictions imposed upon him by the king. That's how far it goes, our need not to be restricted. We'll even be Moser Nefesh, we'll give our lives for it, to disobey, to break a barrier, to take something down which was previously something holy and something special. How does one handle this? Because here we pose a major problem in the practice of Yiddishkeit. One has to be very careful with intellectual Yiddishkeit. I call our kind of Yiddishkeit intellectual Yiddishkeit. What one has to be careful about is that one doesn't start taking the intellectual side too seriously. By that I mean that if I say to you, why do you keep Shabbos, you'll have a long story for me about how it's the most wonderful thing in the world and it's good for you and you're more productive and it's a wonderful day and you're with your families and all sorts of wonderful things. Why do you keep Kashrus? You'll have a similar sermon ready. Why do you keep this? Why do you keep that? There's a reason for everything and it all sounds very beautiful. But at the end of it, that's not why we keep it. At the end of it, we have to be able to keep it because the Ribbono Shel Olam says so. Now what's been wrong Take this community, for example, South Africa. The generation that came out from Lithuania, when asked by their children why, misunderstood the question. They were being asked by their children, why did God say you must keep Shabbos? They thought their children were asking, why do we keep Shabbos? And one has to understand that those are two entirely different questions. If you ask me, why do I keep Shabbos? I keep Shabbos because it says in the Torah you must keep Shabbos. That's why I keep it. Now if you want to ask me, why does it say in the Torah you must keep Shabbos? That I'll explain to you. There are many reasons for that. Some we know, and some reasons we don't know. But as much as we're able to know and understand, I can explain to you. You'll ask me why I put on tefillin. I put on tefillin because that's the din, it's a halacha. That's why I put on tefillin. Why is it the din that one must put on tefillin? That's a different study altogether. And that's what Talmud Torah is. The learning of Torah is not the study of why I keep Yiddishkeit. That's nothing to do with it. The study of Torah is why does God command X, Y, Z, as far as we are capable of understanding. There's got to be an element in every mitzvah of a midah, a concept called Avdus Hashem. The concept of being a servant to God, being a slave to God, that's something we've got to have in every mitzvah. Now how do we avoid that becoming intolerable? It's something so difficult, this concept of Avdus Hashem, that I don't think I've ever spoken about it before in this Beis HaMedrash. Because it's something that is so dangerous of becoming heavy and miserable and restrictive and to cause rebellion, in fact. But here we can confront the problem clearly. There is such a concept as Avdus Hashem. There is such a concept as doing something because God says so. And yet, there's an inherent rebellion against authority within us. How do we ensure, let's first ask, what is the emotion of Avdus Hashem? What am I meant to be feeling when I feel a slave of God? And secondly, how do I achieve that? It's funny how much thrill in the world is built on tension. Movies and novels and all sorts of entertainment is certainly built on tension. The eating experience, what we've just talked about, is also built on a tension. To build up the appetite and to build up the expectation before that tension is released. Because the pleasure is that moment just before the tension is released. The moment of pleasure is not after the tension is released or even when the tension is released. It's just that moment of maximum tension just before there's the release of tension. That's the period of greatest pleasure. So we've got it with entertainment, we've got it with food, we've got it with a dramatic sense. Also, drama bases itself on that. Things are boring without that. One has to build things up to a tension, and the main point has to be made at that moment of tension, because right after that you're finished, you're lost, then it's over. You've got to start building it up again. And you can build up again and build up again, and you get to another point of tension, and you can make your next point, and then you've got to relax it again. That's how we operate. We're at our best, we're at our peak at moments of tension. And our greatest thrills are at moments of tension. And we go to great lengths to try and develop that tension and to sometimes artificially create that tension. So a lot of sports is, and certainly a lot of entertainment. And it's a little bit strange that we seem to run between psychologists and psychiatrists on the one hand to tell us, relax, that you're under too much tension. I'll give you a tablet to release the tension. And that evening you go out to a tension movie, and then the next morning you go to business or wherever it is for a bit more tension, and then you go back to your psychologist who says, relax, you mustn't have tension. So what are we doing? Do you need tension or don't you need tension? Again, it's confusion. We need tension. Tension never did anybody any harm. It's only frustration and aggravation that does people harm. Tension has never killed anybody. It's never hurt anybody. Tension is the most wonderful thing. And it's the a requirement of the art of living to be able to work up to those moments of tension and to utilize those moments of tension before the relaxation that must come afterwards. Sexually it's the same thing. The whole sexual mystique and relationship is built on developing the intersexual tensions. When there are no intersexual tensions, there is no sexual relationship. We'll have more about that on Wednesday night. But the same applies with Avdus Hashem. To create a tension, you need two things. You need a drive and you need a barrier. You need something that's pushing you and something that's stopping you. And then you've got tension. Then you've got challenge. The permissive society destroys all the challenges. So you're left with a drive. But if your drive experiences no resistance, there's no tension. There's no tension, there's no nothing. Avdus Hashem is the emotion experienced by the drive to disobey, encountering the barrier of no, you may not. That's what Avdus Hashem is. Avdus Hashem is as exciting as walking a tightrope or going on a roller coaster or anything that gives you a moment of thrill by being incredibly dynamic and yet dangerous because there's a friction to that dynamicism. It can't just go where it wants. It has to go within a certain framework, and if it breaks out of that framework, it's dangerous. And that's the thrill of Avdus Hashem. Avdus Hashem is not a heavy, dry feeling of I may not, so I won't. Avdus Hashem is the feeling of challenge, the feeling of being torn apart, the feeling of it being sore inside from one's desire and drive to do something, hitting up against the challenge that this is something which may not be done. And that creates a tremendous tension within one's living and a tremendous tension within one's Yiddish mind, within one's learning and one's practicing of Yiddishkeit. That has to be there. If a human being lacks the drive, he won't experience it. Because you can't have Avdus Hashem if you don't have the drive to do wrong. So the famous Gemara says, you mustn't say, I could never eat tripe, I could never eat chaza, I could never do that. That's not what you're meant to say. You're meant to say, Efshi, I could and I would and I would love to. Well, my heir said, what can I do? God said no. That's meant to be our attitude towards certainly those mitzvahs which are not just basic morality, and even those mitzvahs which are basic morality, which the Rambam says we must have an inherent abhorrence of such averas. We must inherently be disinterested and turned off murdering and lying and cheating and stealing. Those are things that every human being just has to know, says the Rambam, and it's sick to have a craving for that. But even there, although we have no craving to steal, still, the reason that I don't steal is not just because I don't have a craving. The reason I don't steal is because it's not allowed. And it's not so simple that one doesn't have a craving either. This is something which Baal Peor totally destroys. To take religion, whatever religion, we're not even talking about Yiddishkeit now, to take an idol, to take any form of religion, and subject it to utter disgust and utter abuse, is basically removing all the obstacles. Now there's nothing left. What is it really? It's not just a saying that the idol is worthless. The avoda of Peor is not just saying we don't believe in Peor or that we don't believe in religion. It's actually the declaration of the ultimate superiority of the human intellect. That's really what it is. There's nothing above me. That's what Baal Peor really is, and that's what all forms of permissiveness really is, and that's what hedonism really is. There's nothing, this is, I'm the ultimate, there's nothing beyond the human being. How does one fight this? One has a tremendous problem. On the one hand, you have this inherent drive to break down the barrier. On the other hand, the barrier is there. And more than fight it, one has to avoid it becoming unpleasant. That's the old example that I've given you before of the man who's told to walk a mile down a very narrow path. He can just about balance one foot on it, it's so narrow. And he has to put one foot in front of the other and walk very slowly down this path, and it's a mile long. And on two sides of it, measured exactly to the width of his body, is the most vicious, horrible barbed wire. And he has to walk, and he knows that one false step and he'll be torn to pieces. He doesn't have a chance. And he's going to do this for a mile, and he walks, and he walks. And whenever he looks up, there still seems to be a mile. And if he looks behind him, it looks like nothing. And it's a nightmare, and it hurts him and bothers him, and he walks and walks and walks. And eventually he gets to his last step, and he just puts his foot out, and he takes his handkerchief out, and he wipes the sweat off his brow, and he runs. Off he goes. Then you have another man on the same path. accepting they've taken away the barbed wire. Same narrow path, and if he falls, he's going to spoil the most beautiful beds of unique flowers that don't grow anywhere else in the world except right here. And they're being bred, and if he spoils them, there'll never be another flower like that in the rest of the world. And there's no barbed wire. But the same, if he just dares fall off, he's going to cause incredible destruction. But not destruction to him, destruction to something else. And when he gets to the end of his mile, he doesn't jump off that quickly, and he certainly doesn't run away. He turns back and he looks. And he feels good. And he isn't sweating. And he feels a thrill. And he walks away with a feeling of richness. Here are two people who've done exactly the same thing. The same achievement with the same sense of balance. And for one it's been a nightmare, and for the other it's been a romantic dream. What's happened? What's the difference? Depends. The one has had the avdus. The one is, don't you dare move off because you'll hurt yourself if you do. And the other is, please don't move off, because if you manage not to move off the trail, you'll achieve a tremendous amount. And that's the difference. And a human being doesn't mind that second way. He doesn't mind achieving. He likes to achieve. And he doesn't mind restricting himself in order to achieve. But let nobody else restrict me. That not. How do we make sure that this avdus, which is so necessary an experience to keep the tension of Yiddishkeit, how does man make sure that that doesn't become heavy and unpleasant and difficult in every sense? Let's just learn a little Mishnah together. Kol mi sheyesh bo shloisha dvorim holalu. This is a Mishnah towards the end of the fifth parak of Ovis. Anybody who has the following three traits is mitalmidav shel Avraham Avinu. He's a Talmid of Avraham Avinu. That means he's learnt from the essential Jewish characteristics developed by Avraham. And if he has another three things instead, then he's mitalmidav. He also has a master, he also has a professor, but his professor is not Avraham Avinu. Then he's mitalmidav shel Bilam Arosha. He's a Talmid of Bilam. And these three midas, as you'll see, are opposites. You're one or the other. Bilam and Moshe constitute the two opposites that somehow encompass all of human nature. You're either following Moshe's way or you're following Bilam's way. Now, what are the criteria? Ayin tova, if you have a good eye. V'ruach nemucho, and a low spirit. V'nefesh shvela, and a low nefesh. Then mitalmidav shel Avraham Avinu. Then you're a talmid of Avraham Avinu. But what does this mean? Ayin tova, ruach nemucho, nefesh shvela. Before we explain what it means, let me just go on. Ayin ro, but if you have a bad eye, v'ruach gvoa, and a high spirit, v'nefesh rechova, and a wide nefesh, then you're mitalmid of shel Bilam Arosha. Then you're a talmid of Bilam. Ma bein talmid of shel Avraham Avinu, the talmid of shel Bilam Arosha. What's the difference then? What's so important as to who your rabbi is, as to who your teacher is, if it's Bilam or if it's Moshe? What difference does it really make? Strange question, but still that's what the Mishnah asks. Answers the Mishnah, Tamidov shel Avraham Avinu, those who follow Avraham Avinu, Oichlin ba'olam hazeh and Oichlin ba'olam haba. They have pleasure in this world and in the world to come. Aval Tamidov shel Bilam Arosha, but the Talmidim, the disciples of Bilam, Yorshim Gehenom veYordim leBe'er Shachet. They just land up in Gehenom and they encounter total destruction. So there are two choices. You either follow Avraham or you follow Bilam. If you're following Avraham, you've got this world and the world to come. If you follow Bilam, you've got neither. Says Rabbeinu Yoinah, Hayayef Shalatana Lekatze V'Shelo La'arich Klal Ufrat. The Tana could have been much shorter, much more brief. Why does he have to go into this long discussion? And Rabbeinu Yonah in fact rewords the Mishnah as to how it could have read equally effectively but much more briefly. Elobol elamdeinu, they come to teach us. Shebegimol dvorim oele, in these three things asher zocha rishono, which he first mentioned, koilelim kol hashlemus. That includes all of human perfection. There is nothing else besides these three factors. If you've got them, you're with Avraham. If you don't, you're with Bilam. That's the long and the short of the whole story of a human being's drive to perfection. These three midas. That's what Rabbeinu Yonah says.
So what are the three midas? Says the Rambam. Ein Tova hi ha-histakus. Ein Tova is the ability to be satisfied with what you've got. V'nefesh shefelo hi ha-zehirus. Nefesh shefelo means being careful, being meticulous. V'ruach namucho hi ha-nova yaseva. And ruach namucho is to be very modest. What does all this mean? That's the ultimate and the totality of human perfection. There are three areas in which a human being drives to break down barriers. The one area is in his professional capacity, in his business life or his professional life. He wants to break down, he wants to achieve, whatever that achievement is. In business, it's making more money. In the professions, it's inventing new things or achieving new heights, whatever it is. Each person wants something new to establish something that hasn't been done before. That's what drives him. The other one is in terms of hedonism. One likes new experiences, one likes to feel new things, one likes new pleasures that one didn't have before. And the third one is mentally, intellectually. We like to create new ideas which we've never had before. How are we going to ensure that a human being's drive for breaking barriers is tolerable and in fact is enjoyable, is part of his avodah Hashem? Firstly. And secondly, if breaking barriers is so negative, why do we have this drive to break them? We know from the Rambam that every drive that the human being has can be used positively. How can we use the drive to break down barriers positively? The answer is obviously very simple. One has to use that drive in spiritual achievement. One has to use that drive in becoming greater, in achieving new things on the spiritual level. That's where one has to use the drive for breaking down barriers. Comes the question, how? The system is in the Mishnah, and it's interesting that it's tied up with Bilam. And Bilam's whole part in this business with Baal Peor is very interesting too. It works exactly like a dam works when you're building a dam. What you need to do is you need to stop the water spreading laterally. That's all. You don't actually have to pile the water up. The water has an amazing property. Once you stop its lateral spread, it automatically goes higher. That's all you have to do. Dam it up. And that's why the Gemara says the Torah is often compared to water. Because you'll always find water running down to the low places. So you'll find Torah in people who are lowly, in people who are humble. What does that Gemara mean? It sounds so childish in a sense. What Chazal mean is something very important. In the same way as water will always travel down to the lowest point and then it will start piling up. That's what Torah does as well. It needs to find itself in somebody whose lateral expansion, or lateral plans of expansion, or rather somebody whose plans for lateral expansion are limited, so that he can start expanding himself in a vertical sense. Because we have to expand, we have to move, we have to break barriers. But the easiest way to break barriers is laterally. It's much harder to break barriers vertically. Yet, it's hard, but you don't have to put much effort into it. It's intuitive, provided you've dammed up the possibility of lateral expansion. As long as the human being has the option of lateral expansion, he'll rather go for that. It's easier to make money than it is to learn another blot of Gemara. It's easier to achieve a new breakthrough in one's profession, if one knows what one's doing, than it is to create a chiddush within Torah. Or to develop a new characteristic within oneself which one's been striving for and not being able to reach. It's easier to become the top man in any profession than it is to become a mensch. Much easier. One of the most difficult accomplishments is just to know Shas clearly, to learn through the whole of the Talmud. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said that just to develop one characteristic is harder than to go through the whole of the Talmud. And he meant the way he goes through it, with his depth of understanding, not the way we go through it today. The way he goes through it, it's easier to do that than to change oneself in one way. Vertical expansion is much, much harder, and there's an inert resistance against that, in favor rather of lateral expansion. We'll always opt for that. And what we've got to develop is the ability to dam up all forms of lateral expansion so that it gets replaced by vertical expansion. And that's this Mishnah here. What are the three areas of lateral expansion? The first one is material. So the first thing you need, if you don't want to be a student of Bilam, is histapkus. the ability to say, I have enough. That's it. To know when to stop. To know how to enjoy what you've got without going crazy running for more. Doesn't mean you're not allowed to have more. It doesn't mean you're not allowed to enjoy more. It's always considered a great privilege to be wealthy and to be comfortable. But to run after it like a mashugana, to sacrifice a quality of life, to sacrifice a family life, to sacrifice a spiritual life, to earn another buck, that way you'll never make progress in Yiddishkeit. So the first thing has to be hystakus. I've got to be able to say at the end of the day, it's enough for today, go home. So I won't reach the top in my business, so my business won't be the biggest. So I'll have to cut down a little bit. No, so what? I can do more at home than I can do here. Or I can go to a shiur or whatever it is. One has to know how to do that. That's the first area in which one must be able to block natural expansion, is in one's material activities. Because you'll find that people who need expansion, the easiest way is to go to buy something. Go and buy something new. Or spend money in some other way. Makes you feel that you're living, you're doing something. You're doing something new, you've got something that you didn't have yesterday. And in order to buy, you have to work for it. And you're fooling yourself all the time into thinking there's progress. The next one is the hedonistic area. If one hasn't got money, then one tries other ways of feeling alive. And one tries to experience in a very hedonistic way, either through eating or other forms of hedonistic experience. One wants to experience a new experience. For that you need Zahirus. Zahirus, says the Rambam, is what the second middah is. If you're going to keep away from Bilam, Zahirus is just the ability to say, I may not, finish, I can't, out. And the third one, as far as mental lateral expansion is concerned, because we have it mentally too, this feeling of progress, this feeling of mental progress without it doing anything to you as a person. So you know a little bit more, so you've thought of something a little bit new, so you've said something witty or something clever, but has it really changed you? Are you operating on a different level? Have you achieved greater degrees of human perfection? No. How do we bear that with another? One needs an intellectual modesty. One needs to know one's own limitations. One needs to know that's not where it's going to be at. Once one's got these three middos, hystakus, one can say enough, and zahirus, one can be careful when it comes to hedonistic pleasure. And another, one has intellectual modesty. Now one becomes frustrated. And this is the most important time of one's development. Now one becomes terribly frustrated. Who am I? What am I? What is life? So you've taken away ambition from me. My business is no longer important to me because I have hystakus. I no longer enjoy. I used to go out for a good meal and we used to go dancing and discotheking. I can't do that now either. So you've taken that away with your zahirus. So all that was left to me was that I was a clever guy and I thought a lot of myself. And I used to say and write clever things. Now I'm an onov. Now I think I'm an idiot and I'm a nothing. And now what's left to life? Is that religion? Now we can stop. This is their business ambition. And you get the zahirus through to them and they stop going out to theatre, movies, reading books or doing anything else, which is more, even less innocuous. And then you finally get them to anova, where they think they're a nobody. They begin to enjoy that feeling of being a non-entity. And they begin to accept that that's religion, Taka, and that's it. They now feel from. And they think that's what God expects of them. Then you've lost, then you have no chance. It's required, obviously, that at this point you're as frustrated as anything. And if you're as frustrated as anything at this point, then we can start making progress, then we can start moving. And how we do that is really very simple, and I learned that once by watching the middah of patience, of savlonus, in a musical player. Since last week we started comparing Yiddishkeit to orchestras, we'll carry it on. This particular girl had a very exciting part to play in a magnificent symphony. And I was watching her right through the symphony because I just wanted to see when it was all going to happen. She was standing, it was a long symphony, I don't even remember which symphony it was, and everybody was very active, it was a very loud one. Everybody was busy right through. She had a little triangle. She was going to have to hit the triangle at the right time. And I was just fascinated by this woman who stands there, and she's going to, the first little bit of music went by and she didn't have to do any hitting. So I was just amazed to try and figure out how much she's going to do. It didn't take me long to realize it was going to be very little. But how does a person do that? Stand there night after night because you've got to make one little tick. So I watched with fascination. And exactly as I thought, so it was. She really had two or three little clings to make at very critical points. And I don't even know if I didn't know that she was clinging that I would have heard it. But knowing it, it was a very, very critical point, and the timing was very critical. But that's not what's important. What's important is what kept her fulfilled. I realized immediately that I wouldn't have been able to do the job. My sense of timing wouldn't have been good enough. She was able to do the job, so she has a degree of talent. What enables a talented person to stand there for an hour and a half doing nothing because you've got to make three clings at a particular time? And the answer is very simple. She's part of a massive symphony. And what gives her the thrill is the symphony and the fact that she's part of it. Not she herself. And perhaps that's the difference. I once heard somebody say, a good choir singer is somebody who makes sure that he can never be heard. Perhaps that's something in a symphony too, as opposed to a soloist playing an instrument. You're not meant to hear the individual. That's not what it is. It's one big orchestra, each one with his contribution and each one with his part. And you can't go and isolate the contributions and say, he played that piece nicely and he played that piece nicely. You're listening to a totality of sound. And each one has contributed to making the whole right. Take out that little piece of triangle knocking and the whole symphony is lacking. Everything's lacking. And she understands that she's part of this massive whole, and her thrill is from the whole musical experience, from the symphony and what she's done to make it what it is and what everybody else has done. And she feels part of them and identified with them and with them all together. And that's what gives her the thrill. And that's what one has to understand here. Once one gets to the level that it's not in another business deal that I'm going to find my fulfillment, and it's not in another bit of hedonistic pleasure that I'm going to find my fulfillment, and it's not only in a bit of clever draying around that I'm going to find my fulfillment. I'm going to find my fulfillment by being part of something massive, of something enormous, of something infinitely deep and infinitely extensive. And I have a part to play in that. V'tein chelkeinu b'Torah Secho. Give us our part in your Torah, however small it is. Give me my part. I want to play. And the understanding of that is what begins to give a man his new areas of fulfillment. And now he starts on depth. Now he understands that it's not just running a little bit further which is going to give him the thrills. Now it's feeling part of something that he understands, something that he's deepening his sensitivity to, something that he's extending his knowledge of. That's what he begins to become related to and he begins to understand. So the Mishnah says one has to dam off the lateral desires for conquest, and they will naturally be replaced by vertical desires for conquest, or rather by desires for vertical conquest. That will be natural. But you have to block off those lateral areas first. And that statement is a statement which the Mishnah gives us to differentiate between Yiddishkeit and Bilam. And Peor, this business with Peor was Bilam's favorite Avodah Zorah, by the way. Not only was it his favorite Avodah Zorah, it was his suggestion that the Moabites should attract the Jewish people into this worship of Peor, because he realized that would destroy them from within. All you have to do is take away the Avdus Hashem. Just give them a few moments of the experience of breaking down barriers. And then they're finished. Then they lose the Avdus Hashem, and they lose that tension which gives to vertical rising. And they're left with absolutely nothing. And finally, that explains the posuk in Va'etchanan, where we're told in Dvorim chapter 4 an instruction, a mitzvah, Lo yitosifu al hadavar asher anochi mitzaveh eschem. You're not permitted to add on to the Torah, but lo yisigru mimenu, you're not permitted to detract from the Torah. Lishmer es mitzvah Hashem elokeichem asher anochi mitzaveh eschem. Einechem aroyes, your eyes have seen Eitz Asher Asah Hashem b'Baal Peor, what God did to Baal Peor. Ki chol ish asher alach achrei Baal Peor, anybody who went after Baal Peor, ishmida Hashem lekechem mikirbecha, God destroyed him from amongst you. What's the one going to do with the other? First comes an instruction of Baal Tigra and Baal Tosif, that you know how to add to the Torah or detract from the Torah. And then as a warning, the Torah tells us, and don't forget what God did to those who followed Baal Peor. What's the connection between Baal Peor and Lo Tosif or Lo Tigra? A person who comes along with Tigra who takes out one bar from the music, just one little mitzvah left, one tiny little thing, he says, that's not for me, I don't accept that. The rest of the Torah is beautiful, fantastic, wonderful, but this I don't accept. That's a man who puts his mind over the symphony. He's changed the whole thing by taking that one bit out. He's not prepared to submit himself to the something greater. That's Lo Tigra, to detract from the Torah. The essential wrong with Lo Tigra is not just the little bit you're taking out. It's placing yourself above the Torah. That's what's no good. And once you place yourself above the Torah, there's no avdus, there's no serving of God. Once there's no serving of God, there are no barriers. If there's no barriers, that's Baal Peor. It's the same thing. And what about Baal Tosif? What happens if I'm a little bit more severe on myself than I should be? That is also the same. A man who says that something is osu when it's not osu. He says it's forbidden when it's not forbidden. A man who creates new laws and new restrictions in the Torah which are not there and are not part of the Torah. Such a man is performing exactly the same mistake. I can do it. I can subject the Torah to my reasoning. That not. That's also Baal Peor. To add to the Torah or to detract from the Torah is the same issue of removing barriers by placing yourself above it. What one needs is an Avdus Hashem. One needs a certain serving of the Ribbono Shel Olam. To achieve that, one needs barriers. For the barriers to be there, you need a superiority over yourself. You need an authority over yourself. That creates a tension. You want to break out. That's fine. Now you've just got to be careful where you break out. Don't break the barriers that God has imposed. Don't start by breaking the interpersonal barriers or the barriers of mitzvahs and averas. Block that out with your zehirus. That's out of the question. You can't do it. If you want to experience breaking barriers, you can't do it in that area. Don't experience it in your business life by breaking barriers and making another million. That you can't do either. Block that out. That's istapkus, ayin tova. And don't even do it by trying to be clever. One of the big problems a lot of people have in their learning all over the world. Rather than subjecting yourself to what the learning says, to subjecting yourself to what the Gemara is saying, what the Torah is saying, what the Rebbe is teaching, what the Rambam says, what the Shulchan Aruch says, rather than subjecting yourself to that, it's utilizing what you're learning and hearing in order to come up with something clever that gives you a bit of satisfaction. So you've broken a new barrier, you've made a little chiddush. The chances are the chiddush is wrong, and even if it isn't wrong, it's likely to be irrelevant. And you've missed the main points on the way. And you've blocked the possibility of really achieving death. No chiddush. Just subject yourself to what you're hearing. And you'll go mad. You'll get frustrated, and you'll experience tension. But what a tension. And that tension will lead to death. That then the water starts automatically. You don't have to do anything. Once you've done that, provided you still have a healthy drive, the tension starts building up. Don't add to the Torah, don't detract from the Torah. That's Baal Peor. Just subject yourself to the Torah. And this restrictiveness of it itself will force you into becoming so creative, so deep and so full of understanding, that you'll grasp things which previously you would have thought are completely beyond you.